What's happening, you beautiful people? Welcome back to the show. My guest today is Graham Tomlinson, aka The Fitness Chef, and we're talking about all of the biggest diet and fat loss myths. Given the fact that if lockdown has left us with anything, it's just a little bit of extra weight, most people are going to be getting back into some form of fitness regime right now, and given that, I thought it would be a good time to come and dispel some of the most common misinformation and myths around dieting, weight loss, fat loss, and everything else. So today, expect to learn the principles of dieting and losing weight, whether juicing or detoxes work, what low-carb and keto actually do, how intermittent fasting works, why slimming clubs don't work, how to keep your fat loss sustainable over time, and much more. I'm a big fan of Graham's work, and he's got nearly a million followers on Instagram because he's a no BS kind of guy. He doesn't really care about which team he's supporting as long as it's a team which works. And if we save just one person from doing another juice detox, I'm going to call this episode a win. All right, quick maths. The less that your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money that you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce the costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you are improving efficiency by bringing all your business processes into one platform. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the maths and see how you will profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/modern right now. That's netsuite.com/modern. This episode is brought to you by Whoop. I've worn Whoop for over 4 years now, since way before they were a partner on the show, and it is the only wearable I have ever stuck with because it's the best. It is so innocuous, you do not remember that you've got it on, and yet it tracks absolutely everything 24/7 via something from your wrist. It tracks your heart rate, it tracks your sleep, your recovery, all of your workouts, your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, how much you're breathing throughout the night. It puts all of this into an app and spits out very simple, easy to understand, and fantastically usable data. It's phenomenal. I am a massive, massive fan of Whoop, and that is why it's the only wearable that I've ever stuck with. You can join for free, pay nothing for the brand new Whoop 4.0 strap, plus you get your first month for free, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can buy it for free, try it for free, and if you do not like it, after 29 days, they will give you your money back. Head to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. That's join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. This episode is brought to you by AG1. AG1 is a daily foundational nutrition supplement that supports whole body health. Even with the best diet in the world, it is hard to make sure that you get everything that you need. And through a science-driven formulation, vitamins, probiotics, and whole food-sourced nutrients, AG1 delivers comprehensive support for the brain, gut, and immune system. This is why Joe Rogan and Lex Fridman and Dr. Andrew Huberman and Tim Ferriss are all massive fans. They have tried every other product out there like I have, and this is by far the best one available. Since 2010, AG1 have improved the formula 52 times in the pursuit of making the best foundational nutrition supplement possible through high quality ingredients and rigorous standards. Also, there's a 90-day money back guarantee, so you can buy it and try it for 89 days. And if you don't like it, they'll just give you your money back. Head to drinkag1.com/modernwisdom for that 90-day money-back guarantee, a year's free supply, vitamin D, 5 free travel packs, and more. That's drinkag1.com/modernwisdom. But now, it's time to learn about the biggest myths of dieting with Graham Tomlinson. Graham Tomlinson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm well, man. I went to Leeds and back today, and this is how downregulated the stimulus of my life has become. I've spent so much time in the same four walls that a journey to Leeds and back actually felt like an adventure. I spent 3.5 hours in the car and literally felt like I'd gone on holiday.
Well, talking of holidays, it doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. Yeah, it's been a funny year, hasn't it, with lockdown? To be honest, I don't know about you, but it hasn't actually affected me that much because, like yourself, I'm kind of working from home anyway. And the only thing that's changed for me is not being able to go abroad or get on a plane to go to London or something like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, not seeing family and friends is not great. But yeah, in terms of work, everyday life, it's not that much different.
No.
At the start, it was actually quite nice.
Dude.
But it's a bit much now.
I said that every introvert, it's now their dream. You know, you don't have to go and do all of the social events that you never enjoyed. But I'm in perfectly fine working on my own, doing my solitary stuff. But after 12 months of being in exactly the same location, even I, like, and if I'm starting to push it, then for the people that are listening who are really social and used to going out and spending tons of time with their friends, and it really is challenging. So yeah, man, I'm looking forward, even if we can't go abroad, I'm just looking forward to lead West Yorkshire not somehow feeling like I should be grateful for it. I shouldn't be grateful for the fucking A1. Do you know what I mean? Like, this isn't yeah. me taking a trip to somewhere exotic. Anyway, we are going to talk about fat loss today. You are the fitness chef on Instagram. You are red pilling people on how to really understand calories from foods, what they think is happening, what's actually happening, and the truth behind weight loss. What are the most common errors that you see people making when they're trying to lose weight?
I think one of them is not understanding what you were just saying there, understanding that A, you need a calorie deficit, so consume less calories than you use each day to lose fat. That is the principle. That is not a method. That is literally the only physiological way you can lose fat. So unfortunately, it's not sexy enough to be marketed. So it kind of misses a lot of people. So a lot of people start trying to lose fat without even understanding that basic element that's required. And so once you start from there and you start going on an extreme intervention like low carb or keto or whatever it is, and you don't understand about calorie balance, you're almost setting yourself up for failure. Another one would be, even if you do understand that you need a calorie deficit, is making it unsustainable. In other words, having it ultra restrictive and aggressive. So for myself, I know my maintenance calories would be around about 2,200, 2,400 for my activity level. And, you know, for the average female, it could be, I don't know, 1,700 to 1,900. But when they go on these calorie counting apps like MyFitnessPal, it asks them, how much weight do you want to lose? Gives them an option, and it'll be like 1 pound a week, 2 pounds, 3 pounds. Of course, they're going to select the biggest amount of weight loss. Why wouldn't you? I would do that. But unfortunately, what that does is that formulates a calorie target of something like 1,000 to 1,200 calories, which, yes, it's a calorie deficit, but it's quite extreme and unsustainable. You'll be very hungry and it'll be difficult to adhere to it. And the most important thing about fat loss isn't the calorie deficit. It's actually adhering to the calorie deficit over a period of time. So those are probably the two main things that I would say that are very basic for people to understand.
What's the maximum weight loss per week that you think people should comfortably aim for? They're not a pro bodybuilder. They haven't got some MMA fight coming up.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because you could easily answer that and say, doesn't matter, because it's just a number on the scale. Now, people do like to measure their weight loss progress by weighing themselves every week. And over a period of weeks and months, if you lose body weight, you will definitely be losing body fat, right? But if I was to weigh myself today and then next Tuesday, I could have lost weight, but it might not be body fat. I could have gained weight, it might not be body fat. So from that perspective, I would just say, if you do want to measure a number, I would say 1 pound a week, the minimum. You know, the minimum, and that's the most achievable thing that you can do. If you do that every week for a year, that's a lot of weight. But unfortunately, people don't tend to think with that mindset. They're thinking, holiday in 2 weeks, have to lose it all by then, or getting married in 2 months, I've done nothing about it, and now I'm going to, you know, do a juice cleanse or something like that, so something crazy.
even 1 pound a week is 3,500 calories, right? Which is a 500 calorie per day deficit, which is still quite a significant deficit to be in. It's if you massive. Think that for a girl on an absolute top end, they would maybe get 2,000 calories, that's a quarter. You're talking about a quarter every single day, not including a refeed, not including a cheat day. And that's just to break 1 pound, half a kilo a week.
Yeah. And even if you had weeks where you didn't lose fat, you know, it can happen. Things come up, you know, well, in a few months' time, a few nights out, hopefully. And so even if it was half a pound a week, that's still a lot of weight over a period of time. But we just don't think like that when we're starting out. A lot of people, because the solutions that are in front of us are shiny and promise the outcome, you know, you will look like this in a month or 2 weeks. That's what people are focusing on, unfortunately. And that's why they're kind of diving into these ultra restrictive calorie deficits, which, to be honest, are fantastic for boxers. You know, if they want to cut weight dramatically, but not for the average person who, you know, hopefully enjoys things like bread and donuts and lasagna, you know, things like that.
To the uninitiated that are listening, how is it that you can still get to eat bread and sugary foods and lasagna and still lose weight? Is there such a thing as a good food or a bad food?
So there can't be such a thing as a good food or a bad food. Food is simply different. Again, that could just be my opinion, but objectively looking at, say, a chocolate bar or an avocado, if the quantities of both were 200 calories, we can see that the avocado has micronutrients, a little bit of fiber in there, beneficial fats, but still 200 calories. That's the energy value. And that's the thing that's related to the body fat at the end of the day. The chocolate bar will have 200 calories and probably minimal nutrients, certainly no fiber. So yeah, I mean, you can weigh it up. And I think I always try and get people to understand the two different facets. So energy, the calories in food, and also the nutritional value and the fiber value, things that are going to benefit your overall health and influence your next decision. You know, if something satiates you and fills you up, it's more likely that less likely that you're going to eat more calories than you should. So I think, you know, this good and bad thing, I think it's a little bit pedantic of me to say nothing can ever be good or bad. I think it's more a case of there can be a good or a bad overall diet, aka one that supports you or doesn't support you. But as an individual choice, like one meal out of a week is one meal out of 21 meals. You know, if that was something that was double the calories than you normally have, it's not going to make much difference as long as all the other meals are kind of still supporting you. So yeah, it's one of my kind of pet hates is when I say people saying I've been good or I've been bad. Because what it does is when people eat something like a pizza or a chocolate bar, they feel guilty. Of course, if they were doing that every day, potentially it's not going to be optimal for them. But if they're doing it in moderation and they understand more about the food they're eating, it's a lot easier for them to make informed decisions about what they're eating.
So getting on to some of the biggest myths of fat loss, there's been, if this is the case, because I remember when If It Fit Your Macros came out publicly.
The launch of If It Fits Your Macros.
Yeah, and that was what, maybe like 2011, 2012, yeah. I'd say, kind of the back end of the Ziz era, that sort of timing. If It Fit Your Macros came out, everyone had been into carb backloading for a long time, then Carbonite came out, and then it was just, it's any calories, bro. So if it's been, yeah, it's any calories, bro, for the best part of a decade now, nearly 10 years of the If It Fits Your Macros world, why have we seen stuff like keto and intermittent fasting and slimming clubs and all this sort of stuff? Before we get into trashing them, which is going to be great, how have they come up? Is it just repackaging things in a sexier way that's easier to market?
Yeah, I mean, I think the keto diet came around initially to treat epileptic kids, you know, nothing to do with body composition. And low carb diets could be seen to be advantageous for treating people with type 2 diabetes. But these things always tend to morph into fat loss because everybody wants to lose fat because we're a nation, and to be honest, the whole planet is quite obese now, it's naturally going to move into that because that's what people are seeking, I guess. You know, that's my kind of, that's how I kind of think it's happening. Yeah, I think like the it's all calories, bro. It's an interesting one because obviously you've got the three different macronutrients. You've got the protein, which is just great for any fitness goal that you have. It's going to help you build muscle. It's probably going to help you lose fat as well because you burn more calories when you digest that compared to carbs and fats. So over time, that's actually going to help you lose weight because your energy expenditure is higher. But I guess like the low carb, for me, it probably kicked off when, well, in my opinion, everything started when I started going on social media, but it could have been before that in blogs. But yeah, you have low carb and keto zealots that use the kind of insulin hypothesis to get past their argument or to support their argument instead of...
What is that? What's the insulin hypothesis?
Well, it's the idea that that hormones will dictate fat loss instead of energy balance. So the more the insulin rises, the more fat, because it's the fat loss storage hormone, it's basically going to result in more fat loss. And they just ignore the fact that, despite the fact that that's true, insulin is there, it does occur, it's definitely a massive part of the process. The end result is defined by total energy in versus total energy out. That's what dictates it. So yeah, it's kind of like cherry picking a segment of the process between somebody eating calories and it being metabolized and turned into fat tissue. They're checking that one part of the process and just using that. And that's where you get the low carb thing from. That's where you get anti-sugar from. You know, the sugar one's a little bit more vicious in the sense that people claim that it is, you know, poisonous or turn straight to fat, all these kind of ludicrous claims that are just not supported anywhere in evidence. And then you get the other side of it, whereby if somebody enjoys low carb diets, they can do without things like pasta, bread, you know, any type of high sugar food, and it helps them achieve their goals. Fantastic. But the problem comes when people are trying to lose weight and they enjoy those foods and they feel they have to cut them out and it's just unnecessary. There's no kind of evidence there. In fact, all the evidence goes against what some of these hypotheses are saying. You can look at things like the rice reduction diet experiment, where participants ate 95% of their calorie intake from rice, fruit, and fruit juice, pretty much all carbohydrates. In there, and they were in an aggressive calorie deficit. You know, you certainly wouldn't administer the calorie deficit they were on, but guess what? They lost an average of like 63.9 kilos across participants because they were in a calorie deficit, and that was just eating purely carbs. And then we have another meta-analysis from 2 or 3 years ago where they tested two different groups, a low-carb group and a low-fat group. They equated calories and protein in each group. So they're eating the same amount of calories, same amount of protein. And then they just wanted to see which group resulted in more fat loss. And they couldn't find any difference. In fact, I think they found an insignificant difference between low fat resulting in more fat loss than the low carb diet group. And that was a meta-analysis of lots of different studies out there. So there's two examples of quite reliable research to just, I mean, if you say that to somebody who is like an anti-carb zealot, they can't say anything to that. It's like, well, how can you argue? How did that happen then if what you're arguing is true? So, yeah.
But what do they say to that? What's the answer to that?
Well, to be honest, the conversations that I have with low-carb zealots are normally in my Instagram comments section. And they will come out with all these claims. And I will probably come back with, well, can you cite some evidence? And they'll probably come back with some sort of study that's been done, because people talk about showing evidence, but actually there's a lot of bad evidence out there as well. Like anybody could do a study and publish it. That's why you kind of want to look for systematic reviews or meta-analysis, because it's like all the studies done on any given question, such as do carbs make you fat? you're more likely to get a more reliable answer if you look at that kind of data as opposed to just one individual study that was done in 1993, which supports your bias. And there you go, that supports it. But I'm saying, well, hang on, yeah, but what about this? You know, I see what you're saying there with that evidence, but can you not appreciate what I'm showing here? Nope.
Why do you think it is? Why do you think it is that people are so patriotic about the dietary team that they're on?
It's crazy. It's definitely getting worse, I think.
Is that right? Because I only see these discussions when I observe you or James Smith or Dirren or any other of the vanguard of like British argumentative blokes on the internet killing the dreams of some marketer out there. Yeah. I only ever observe it happen, right? So I only get to see a tiny little sliver, but you reckon it's getting worse?
Yeah, I just think people's ability to even debate, you know, I'd quite happily, if somebody wrote a comment saying, yeah, but I don't agree with that respectfully because look at this and this and this, I would be more than happy to admit that I was wrong if I had kind of jumped the gun on something or not appreciated the other side of someone's argument. In fact, I've maybe done that in the past. But just it's more the argumentative kind of nature of people's comments. It's more like they're just angry and they want to project that instead of them actually wanting a discussion that's going to help either one of us. So, yeah, it's very difficult to communicate with people like that. But it is tribal. I think it possibly started with veganism, you know, because my sister's a vegan and, you know, she's a nice person. but you will get people out there who are just wanting to project almost an authoritarian manner how everybody should be doing things. And they just can't take it when someone else wants to do something different because they're entitled to.
Is that not the same way as it is with everything at the moment, though? So think about the patriotism that you see between people's political parties at the moment, or towards a social cause, or towards a particular type of injustice, or whatever it is. I think this is a rabbit hole we don't need to go down, but the collapse of grand narratives, the lack of a religion to hang on to, the fact that you don't have any greater sense of purpose, it's a meritocracy, you are your job, you are your possessions, you are your follower count. People are looking for their new gods, and they appear to be finding them inside of a diet book at the moment.
Or a social media account, or a plethora of a small kind of niche of social media accounts. That's a great point. You know, as you know, our kind of age group, a lot of my mates aren't religious, and probably my parents aren't religious either. So it probably stretches to people who are kind of in their 50s or 60s as well. So yeah, it could be that as human beings, we're always craving something to follow, something to believe in. That's why I support Liverpool at football, stupidly sometimes, this season anyway. It's like, why did I pick them and why do I get so worked up when I watch them on TV? It's, you know, looking at it objectively, it's just a football match. You know, if they win or lose, it has no impact on my life at all.
And yet it does, emotionally, massively.
And yet it does,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I had a sociologist on the show a couple of months ago, a guy called Rob Henderson, who's a good buddy, and he told me that up until 2012, supporters of the Democratic Party in America loved their party more than they disliked the other one. And that was the same for Republicans as well. But after 2012, people that voted Democrat because they hated the other party more than they liked their own. Well, literally, the compulsion that we have now is an in-group, out-group relationship where all that we're bothered about is not being the out-group, as opposed to actually being the in-group. And I think what you see here is we just want to feel like we're a part of a team, a part of a crowd. Like if you're some 39-year-old triathlete, club-level triathlete, who is adamant that low-carb is the way to go, and all of your waking hours are spent researching the different type of bike clip mechanism that you're going to use and the new type of shoes, and you're waiting for race weekend to come around, that's your world. And if you are just as patriotic about that, it feels when someone says, yeah, mate, but it's any calories, bro. Like low carb is for people with epilepsy and type 2 diabetes. It doesn't matter. that doesn't just feel like a critique of the food that you put in your mouth. It feels like an existential threat against your ego. It feels like someone's trying to destroy your identity.
It's an attack, isn't it? And before actually sitting back and thinking about, you know, assessing what information that they're seeing, it's an immediate impulse reaction, isn't it, to go and comment and say, you're wrong, you know? And it's, I think we all do it to some degree, but I certainly notice it on social media with when it comes to nutrition. I've had posts, you know, things like avocado toast versus Nutella toast, just displaying the simple facts. There you go. You do what you like. You can have either, you know, displaying the facts about diet soft drinks, you know, that they don't cause cancer despite all these conspiracies, and they don't make you fat because they've got zero calories. They don't raise insulin because they've got zero calories. But people are just like, yeah, but it's poison, bro. And it's just like, well, what can you say to that? You know, if it was poison, people would be dying.
Have there been any studies that have shown links with artificial sweeteners?
In rats a while ago, but in human beings, there's none. I mean, that's to my knowledge. You know, I think the most recent meta-analysis was done in 2015. And it had over 500,000 participants there, and it showed no carcinogenic properties within diet soft drinks. Specifically, it was aspartame. So there are other sweeteners, but aspartame is the one that gets labeled.
One of the most researched food supplements in the world, right?
It is, and it's one of those things that people will say, I can't believe you're promoting this. I'm like, I'm not. It's like, I can't believe you're saying it's healthy. I'm not. There's nothing optimal about aspartame, but what I'm saying is, the research shows it's actually not harmful if consumed in this dose. If you consumed 100 cans a day, that's a different story. but if you're doing that, there's problems there that you probably need to get help with.
There are other issues bigger than the aspartame, yes.
I would imagine you'd have other issues overriding the problem with aspartame if you're doing that per day. Just having all that bloating, for example.
Purely the recycling issue, I think, would be a big one. Okay, so that's low carb. What about intermittent fasting?
So intermittent fasting can be a short one. It's one that's gained momentum probably in the last sort of 5 or 6 years, and basically all it is skipping a meal, unless you are crazy and want to start doing your intermittent fasting at a different time. Most people would start eating at 12 o'clock and then finish eating at 8 p.m. or something like that, so that they can combine sleep with some of the fasting period. But, I mean, we're all intermittent fasting as long as we sleep. You know, if we're not eating when we're sleeping, we're all doing it anyway. So what's going on is they are skipping probably 4 hours, aka breakfast, and putting it off until lunchtime. There is no research benefits that is better for fat loss than just having a calorie deficit. And regardless of doing intermittent fasting or not, you must be in a calorie deficit to lose fat. So you can have a situation where someone skips breakfast, doesn't track the calories or isn't aware of it, and consumes in a surplus from 12 o'clock to 8 o'clock. But they're still doing intermittent fasting and they think it's going to result in fat loss. No, you still need a calorie deficit. So if you like doing that, I definitely recommend it. If you're somebody who doesn't like breakfast or never eats breakfast, it could be a really useful way to reduce calorie intake. But if you're someone who likes breakfast, then it's unnecessary. You know, some people might feel dizzy by 10 o'clock if they haven't eaten. It just depends. So yeah, that's it. There's also other purported health benefits like autophagy, so like cleaning out of organs, basically, this kind of stuff. And again, is there going to be that much more of that going on? So that's something that occurs when you don't eat for a while.
How long
is it going to be? Well, it will happen, I don't know, a few hours. I haven't actually looked in detail at the research, but if there was three or four hours that you extended that by, is that going to make that much of a difference to your overall health? If there was that benefit, because you're going to be fasting between, say, I don't know, 10 p.m., 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. when you're sleeping. Is there going to be that much more of a benefit, if there are benefits in the first place that get purported, by delaying that by 3 hours or 4 hours? I'm not sure. I guess there needs to be more research in that, but a lot of people claim that's one of the benefits of it.
I would say, from my experience with intermittent fasting, that a restricted time eating window is a good rough tool to assist with generally not eating as much food. Like if you do, if you do a 18-6 fast, which is a little bit more uncomfortable, maybe eating between 2 p.m. and 8 p.m., it's pretty hard actually to overeat in a 6-hour window. You need to be able to put away, especially if you're still eating relatively whole foods that aren't hyper calorie dense, to fit what, like 2 to 3 big meals in within the space of 6 hours is a fairly difficult task. So long as you find that tough. Yeah. As long as you can get through that period. Another thing as well to kind of fly the flag for intermittent fasting, I have found sometimes when I've done intermittent fasting that my energy levels are more stable throughout the morning, that a lot of the time my morning meal can cause me to feel a bit of a slump, sort of mid-morning to afternoon. And then without that spike in insulin and glucose, I don't have that sort of, oh my God, I need a coffee to stay awake sensation.
Yeah, if that works for you, carry on doing it. And you made a great point about inadvertently, if you have to cram in 3 meals to 6 or 7 hours, there's a good chance that you will probably select foods that are going to fill you up because you know that afterwards you are not going to eat for a while. You know, and you could be then inadvertently focusing on or becoming educated on knowing, okay, let's have a high protein diet then because that fills you up. Let's make sure that I'm focusing on whole foods, which has always got to be the basis for any kind of optimal diet. Let's increase fiber intake so that I'm kind of satiated and I'm not, you know, having midnight snacks, which I've been doing during lockdown, to be honest.
Is there any evidence about timing of food intake? If I eat at carbs at 10 p.m. at night, am I going to be more likely to store them as fat because I'm being sedentary while it's in my stomach?
No, there's no evidence out there that suggests that the time that you eat makes any difference to the amount of fat that you're going to store. So I think it's just over a 24-hour period, the total calories in versus the energy expenditure. So yes, you know, in that basic term, that is it. But obviously other things are going to influence that. So if you starve yourself for 7-8 hours, there's a good chance that you could overeat or binge. You know, I've done it before, gone on Deliveroo and I've been absolutely starving and ordered like 2 mains, a starter, a dessert, and before you know it's like 5,000 calories. So yeah, there could be behavioral aspects that you could look at there, but in terms of just looking at the energy in versus energy out, doesn't matter. Do what you like. And it's the same with the amount of meals. A lot of people were saying 6 small meals is better for your metabolism than, you know, 2 massive meals of the same calorie value. Again, it doesn't matter. Just do what suits you. Somebody who likes...
What about protein intake?
Yeah, protein intake, I'd always recommend at least 1 gram per kilo of body weight. And I guess if you are training quite a lot, you could go up to 2 and beyond. I think that's something that a lot of people miss and a lot of people... Because you require it for muscle building and for fat loss, it's going to be beneficial because it's got a higher thermic effect and because behaviorally it's going to help fill you up. People often miss that out and maybe just concentrate on the calories and maybe aren't aware of the amount of protein that they are eating. And it's actually quite low. And over time, it could possibly contribute to them overeating more calories because they're not fueling full, for example. So, yeah. There's also some other crazy myths that, you know, we've seen that people were kind of saying proteins is bad for you as smoking and it wrecks your kidneys. It's just, again, it's just complete nonsense. And something that the Daily Mail would just reel out every now and again.
The internet attracts some interesting people. What about the fact that I think I've definitely seen James post this and you may have done as well, that during one sitting, there's an upper bound ceiling on how much protein your body can absorb.
Yeah, there's various research out there, but 30 grams seems to be the optimal kind of dose for most people. And I guess the average person or the average male should be consuming, I don't know, 2,000, 2,500, maybe 3,000 calories a day, and female from like 1,700 to 2,200. So it's going to be roughly ballpark for most people. To be honest, it's something that's still being researched quite a lot, but from the evidence that I've seen, it's definitely a better idea to aim for kind of 20 to 40 gram servings of protein, rather than, for example, at the end of the day, realizing that you haven't eaten much protein and you try and whack in like 100 grams or something in one meal.
That's what I'm thinking about, the related to having an intermittent fasting window, that inevitably, if you've got an upper bound of about 30 grams that you can absorb optimally within one sitting, how long is the reset window between that? Do you know?
No, I think it would be, no, that's something I'll probably have to have a look at, actually. Whether it's relevant for somebody who's trying to lose weight, I'm not sure. But for somebody who's trying to build muscle, that's definitely something that they should kind of think about. But I guess some of the research that I've seen, I don't know if you've seen some of Alan Aragon's stuff, he's sort of talking about every possibly 3 to 4 hours having more protein. I think that's certainly in research showing to be beneficial for muscle gain. For fat loss, I'm not sure that it really matters.
That's interesting.
How regularly you have it. Just because for muscle gain, you are, I mean, intermittent fasting for muscle gain might not be the best idea, because you are depleting yourself for a long period of time. And of course, yes, you can be losing fat during that time for as energy, but also muscle. You know, muscle is probably the first thing that's going to be burned before fat there. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I was definitely thinking that. I remember seeing Dan Bilzerian talk about his approach to diet. And his approach to diet is to just have 25 grams of protein every 2 hours that he's awake. That's all that he does. So he'll have a protein bar, then he'll have a shake, then he'll have a little food. I mean, when you're constantly surrounded by, when you live in the Maldives or wherever it is, he can just get tapas, presumably, on, like, he just clicks clicks his fingers
on
and
tap,
some handsome Spanish waiter comes over with a penny on and, like, delivers him some nice sort of seafood paella or something like that. But yeah, and that really stuck with me, because it made me think, okay, if there's an upper bound on how much protein you can absorb, if we're focusing on muscle gain, upper bound on how much protein that you can absorb within a particular window, let's say that it's a couple of hours, and you need to be hitting maybe 160 to 180 to maybe even 200 grams of protein per day. If you're an all right size guy who's been training for a little while with a bit of mass on, and you're going for that 2 to sort of 2.5 grams per kilo of body weight, you have to eat consistently, or else you're getting to the point where, right, here's 300 grams of chicken breasts that I'm just going to have in one meal. And that's going to be, what, 75 grams-ish of protein, between 60 and 75 grams of protein you're going to get out of 300 grams of chicken breast?
But maybe more.
Based on what we've just said there, that's not even going to be absorbed. Yeah. So it does need to be little and often for those people, perhaps.
Absolutely. And also, I guess for somebody who's training quite regularly, maybe training twice a day, having the fuel to fuel that workout, it makes sense. You can have protein before that in a balanced meal, you know, within an hour to 2 hours afterwards to start recovery, and then later in the day maybe having an evening meal. So that's things that are kind of meals that are required for the training, to optimize the training anyway. So I guess for a lot of people it would already be in place, but certainly for muscle gain it's something that people probably, yeah, it can probably get a bit much. It's like, oh my God, another meal. You know, you're probably full, and it's 8 o'clock at night, and you know you're trying to get that surplus up there. You're trying to get the protein up there. You realize that you still have another 30 grams of protein to hit. You know, I guess you could have something like a protein shake, but yeah, it's tough. It's a lot more intricate gaining muscle than it is losing fat.
You think so?
And I mean that physiologically. But psychologically, it's probably harder to lose fat for people who have ingrained beliefs, ingrained habits, and it's just about trying to shift that to change their behaviors over time. Whereas for muscle gain, it's more, yes, you do need to appreciate how much protein you're eating, how many calories you're eating here, what's the progressive overload on your training stimulus, all this kind of stuff. So it's, that can be psychological as well, but I think it's more kind of psychological for fat loss when it comes to that.
I'd agree. I think nobody stumbles onto consuming 200 grams of protein a day. Nobody in history has ever accidentally consumed 200 grams of protein. The only person that's ever done that is someone who's going out of their way to hit a protein target. In the same way as no one ever in history has accidentally been in a consistent calorie deficit for a long time. It's not you have to do it to achieve the thing that gets you the output that you want for fat loss or for muscle growth. It has to be conscious. Because it's just 200 grams of protein is a lot of food, and being in a calorie deficit is uncomfortable. It doesn't just happen by chance, so it needs to be planned.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yeah. What about slimming clubs?
Yeah, so they've been around for a long time. Certainly, you know, am I allowed to say them on here? It's fine.
Oh yeah, fire away, man. Fire away. I've got a lawyer now. I've got a lawyer, everybody. So if this happens, it's James Smith's lawyer. I got referred to James Smith's lawyer. So
yeah, he had a legal case a while ago. I don't know what it was.
If she can handle,
obviously got him out of it.
Dude, if this lady can handle the shit that James Smith throws at her,
good point.
She can deal with you naming whoever it is.
Yeah. So Weight Watchers and Slimming World are the big two. Probably, you know, I think they're quite big in America as well, but obviously huge here in the UK. They've been going for a while. When I was doing one-to-one personal training, a lot of the clients that I was getting were kind of ex-Slimming World people who had kind of had enough of just turning up and getting weighed every week and going home and trying to eat sins and free foods and all this stuff, turning up the week after, finding out that they've lost weight, don't know why, the next week gained weight. And it's all based on that. So it's like a win or lose arena. And every time they were kind of turning up, you know, there were stories of people, you know, not eating all day because they wanted to lose weight, or, you know, turning up in swimwear so that the weight of the clothes weren't going to show on the scales, all this kind of crap. And I think, the main problem is just that a lot of people will say this in the industry, they are just withholding the principle from their members. So that is the calorie deficit. Nowhere on their websites, or to my knowledge, at their meetings or weigh-ins, do they communicate this? It's all about telling people to eat a certain amount of sins, or you can eat unlimited salmon, pasta, eggs, which are fairly calorie-dense foods, but you can eat unlimited quantities of them. And the argument that I always get from Slimming World zealots on my posts is, yeah, but nobody does that. I'm like, I'm sure nobody does that. However, this is what they're saying on their website. You can eat unlimited quantities of this stuff, which can easily result in you being in a calorie surplus.
Dude, if you gave me unlimited access to pasta, I could put myself in a calorie surplus easily.
Yeah. Oh yeah, me too. I mean, I am very much of the mind, I'm very much half a pasta packet per meal, which is probably like 150 grams uncooked, maybe more. So you can imagine someone whose calorie deficit target may be something like 2,000 calories, all of a sudden in one meal, they're having 950 calories or something without knowing it. But it's fine because it's free. It's just this kind of thing. There's just lack of information there. And it's kind of the same with Weight Watchers. They use the point system. It's maybe slightly more aligned to calories. I think the points are added up depending on the calories in food. But it's like, why not just
do the fucking calories? People?
Yeah,
this is a mad thing. Like, I don't know why they have to take what is an already very well established existing system of measuring and then repurpose it into a thing that isn't.
It's because, you know, their marketing team must be fantastic. You know, people there who are saying, right, we know that it's a calorie deficit, but we can call it something else because we know that people think, God, counting calories, how tedious and boring, which probably is, you know. But let's dress it up as this and call this a sin and a speed food and a free food. All of a sudden, it sounds more sexy. And all of a sudden, the measurement mechanism is just so basic, people can understand it. They turn up, if they've lost weight, success. If they've gained weight, no, you're failing. But as we know, you know, your body weight is not reflective of your body fat. You know, if you could turn up 1 week and have eaten loads of salty foods the night before, so retain more water, and that's the extra weight. You might have actually lost body fat, but gained weight from 1 week to the other. So that's why the scales over those short periods of times aren't overly useful. And that's, yeah, that's basically it. I think it's just, yeah, it's taking people further away from the very basic principle that they need to know, for no reason other than profits, you know. And I guess, yeah, we're all businesses. We want to make money at the end of the day. But I can't help but feeling that both of those organizations, their success as a business depends on their members' failure, because that means that they're going to keep coming back.
It's a physio that never wants his athletes to get well.
Yeah. We see that with chiropractors a lot, and to be honest, there's probably some great chiropractors in there. But it's like, yeah, come here every 2-3 weeks. It's like, well, hang on a minute. It's not actually the bones that are the problem here. It's the muscles that keep pulling bones out of place. So as soon as I leave here, I'm going to be out of joint again in, like, I don't know, a day. So it's probably that I need to kind of take care of. Flexibility, a little bit of strength training here or there is going to solve my problems long term, rather than paying 80 quid every 3 weeks coming for you to do the same thing. That's not to say it's not necessary. It absolutely is in a lot of cases. But that's the kind of, yeah, similar to Slimming World in that regard.
Is there a way that I can prioritize fat loss through foods when in a calorie deficit?
Yeah, there is. So there's no particular foods that will help fat loss, and there's no particular foods that will make you gain weight more than others. It's all about the overall energy in and out. However, that said, we touched upon it before, foods high in protein. So because protein has a higher thermic effect, you're talking about every time you have protein, about 30% of those calories that derive from protein from that food are burned during digestion. So that's an increase in your energy expenditure, but the net calories is, yeah, 30% less than the total calories that you're actually consuming. For carbs, it's around about 10%, and for fat, it's 0-3% is what the data says, which is all the more interesting that keto zealots tell you to eat loads of fat. And what they're basically saying is, what they think is happening is, the more fat that you eat, the more fat you'll burn. So they're making that seem more body fat you'll burn, but it's actually just the dietary fat that you're consuming in wheelbarrows that you're burning. Because you've got zero carbs in your system, the carbs are being used as fuel. It's so annoying because people believe that stuff. Anyway, off topic. Other foods, like we were saying there, whole foods, you know, foods high in fiber, again, is going to help make you feel full, just like protein. And the more that you feel full, the more or the less likely you are to overeat. So from that point of view, you want to look at it from the overall diet still. And if you know that, for example, you're eating three meals, each of them have 30 to 40 grams of protein, then you can look at it. And if you know you're eating a bunch of micronutrients, it's going to improve your overall health, bunch of fiber, it's going to, you know, improve your digestion, you're taking care of the overall picture. You know that one donut, which is 200 calories, as long as it fits your overall calorie target over a week, you know, you can be flexible, that's going to do nothing bad for your goal or your overall health. So yeah, the two things to focus on would be protein and fiber, sort of upping them just so that you feel cooler.
Awesome. What about low calorie diets? Yeah.
It depends how low. So I guess to lose fat, you always need to be lower calories than you're currently consuming, unless you're, you know, exponentially increasing your energy expenditure to create a deficit. But I don't know how low you mean. Do you mean like 400 calories a day?
Yeah, well, I mean, we see these, right? We see these diets on the internet of girls who are prepping for bodybuilding shows and have been told by their coach to drive themselves into the ground. 900 calories or 1,000 calories, they're doing morning cardio, they're doing afternoon weights.
So, yeah, I mean, for that level of competition, you know, I personally would never want to be involved in that, but perhaps it's required. But for the average person, that is going to be so miserable. And, you know, what happens when you're miserable, you don't want to keep doing whatever it is you're doing. And the chances are your behaviors will go back to what you were doing before that was creating the problem. So what I always say to people is, instead of having a calorie target per day, have it per week. So say it was 2,000 calories over 7 days, that would be 14,000. And that allows someone the flexibility to know that they can go out and go over by 700 calories and the next day it's fine. You know, just reduce the next few days by 100 calories each or something like that, just to be more flexible. But yeah, in terms of low calorie diets, if somebody really enjoys eating 500 calories a day and they do that for a significant period of time, they will lose a lot of body fat and it will be quicker than if they just had a gradual, say, 20%, 15% calorie deficit, which is going to be slower, but in the long run, more likely to be successful. So there's two options there.
What does the evidence say about juicing and detox?
Well, to be honest, there's none. So, there's not much out there. So the claim is that if you go on a juice cleanse or a detox, you are presumably detoxing your organs. I mean, a lot of the businesses that promote these things don't actually know what they're saying. It's just like a bunch of words saying, going to cleanse your organs, lose weight. It's just all the buzzwords, really. But logic would tell you that unless you don't have organs like kidneys and lungs and liver and skin, unless you don't have those, you will be detoxing naturally anyway. That's what they do. So there's no need. You cannot detox. And things like, we've seen crazy things like coffee enemas. I haven't seen them, thank God, but I've heard of them. I'd just quit. I just move to a remote island, just spend the rest of my days looking at the waves, I think, if I saw that. But yeah, you get all kind of these things. Some of them promoted by medical practitioners as well, which is hard because they're supposed to be trustworthy sources of information and advice. And you're saying there like a juice diet. Some people do that for fat loss because it's ultra low calorie. So if they did it, I mean, what's the most popular one? Lose 7 pounds in 7 days. So a lot of people do it for 7 days, lose the weight, and then just go back to their old habits. So in a couple of weeks' time, they're back to square one, you know, completely pointless. They've just shelled out 300 quid for a juicer, 200 quid on ingredients, felt like crap, shitting themselves at work, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it's completely ridiculous. But that's kind of where we are. That's the power of marketing.
BoomBod is the desiccated powder version of a juice cleanse, right?
So the BoomBod bases its claim on glucomannan, however you pronounce that word, which is basically something that suppresses appetite. And there is some evidence to support that. But is that something that we really want to be promoting to essentially young women, maybe teenage women? Because a lot of the influencers that were, I mean, it's not happening so much now because fortunately so many of us have called it out.
Dude, that was like,
yeah.
You remember, you know, the final
scene. A couple of years ago.
You know, the final scene in Avengers? Where the entire, you got the Wakanda people, you got those big slugs floating through the air, Spider-Man's back, like Thor's just come, Iron Man's leading the way, like that was what it was like. It was all hands on deck. The Lord of the Rings, that the Battle of the Two Towers, it was precisely it was. But God, what a sight to behold.
I think it was because the marketers are obviously just thinking about who's the target market, who's going to fall for this.
Yeah.
And it would be impressionable young people. You know, remember when you were a teenager, I'm the same, I would have done anything. And unfortunately, they're targeting, you know, these kind of reality TV celebrities, you know, really strong followings, really popular. And there we go. And that's what was happening. But I don't think they appreciated the evidence-based community within the industry and how it was just going to immediately go for that. And not just evidence, just
eviscerate them.
Yeah, just people, you know, people who just know when something's wrong.
Plain,
you know,
common fucking
regardless.
Sense.
Yeah, exactly. And to be honest, the influencers who were promoting it, part of me feels sorry for them because they probably just didn't appreciate that either. Probably not educated in basic nutrition and they're just seeing it as...
They were caught in the crossfire.
...means to get money. Yeah, so I kind of do sympathize with them a little bit, but at the same time, need to kind of research what you're promoting at the same time. You know, there's not really many excuses.
I've said it on the show, man. We have a lot of sponsors on here, and I don't promote anything if I haven't used it. Athletic Greens reached out to me. I used the product for all of 2021 up until March before I agreed to do anything with them. So I was like, I want to see what this product's like. It's not enough that Tim Ferriss thinks it's good. I want to actually see if I rate it. And this is the one part that I think is one of the best externalities of there being almost like a call-out culture for bullshit now with regards to fitness and diet on Instagram, is that the amount of reputational damage that you can have, that you can give to someone who continually compromises on truth to get an influencer check, if there is that person. So a good example of the reversal of this is someone like Holly Hagen.
Yes.
So she appears to have almost been a convert now, and she's part of the evidence-based community. Having been on the reality TV side, probably did something similar to a Boom Bod ad, I'm pretty certain I saw her do it. But then you have other people who are prepared to compromise their integrity for a paycheck. And as you roll the clock forward, the race to the bottom is not going to continue to win, because all of the people are just not going to buy the product. If they know that this week you're doing charcoal toothpaste, which doesn't work, and next week you're doing Boom Bod, which doesn't work, and the week after that you're doing some one of those waist trainer things, which doesn't work. Do you know what I mean? Like, every time that they do that, there's no social capital left. And from my side, I'm more than happy to see that happen, because it means that for those of us that have decided to go integrity first, you with your cookbooks, like, you're not trying to flog a special super secret sauce with pomegranates or whatever way you squirt it in your eye. Like, it's just, here's some low calorie foods, here's how to eat them. And the same thing with James. Like, James is providing what is, in the nicest way possible, a really simple solution. Like, his academy is just, here's some calories, here's some training, here's some accountability, go to the fucking gym. Like, that's all it is. That's all it is.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, most of the time, that's all people need. It just doesn't sound, you can't, like, it's hard to do some sort of, like, digital ad with that, or, like, a billboard. It's just, like, common sense or these kind of things. People just kind of, the way things are now with advertising, you know, things have to be extreme to get noticed. And the thing with my second, the second book, Still Tasty, is all I did was think, well, what am I going to do for another book? And it was lockdown, and my followers, what I did was put out a poll saying, what's your favorite recipes? You know, and a lot of people come back with burgers, pizzas and toasties and cheesecakes, whatever. I'm like, well, to be honest, there's easy ways that I can make these lower in calories. And it's the same volume of food, but it's the same tastes as well. So it's like, but possibly 200-300 calories less. And it's like, well, that's an intervention someone could easily make to lose fat. You know, still eating all their favorite stuff. They're not, you know, buying this superfood cookbook where they have to eat edamame beans wrapped in avocado and Cress or something every morning at 6 a.m. But you know what it's like? I was looking at all the cookbooks, and it's just like all these cookbooks, even the ones that are like just meal prep, are all using the lose weight. It's just like, get healthy recipes, lose weight. So they're just using all the buzzwords. I'm like, hang on a minute. You're not giving any advice for someone to lose weight there. You're just giving a bunch of recipes that are nutritious. So that's inadvertently good for someone. But if they want to lose weight, you need to actually tell them how and give them some sort of like information about it. So in each recipe, I'm saying, this is how you save these calories. What I did was changed 10 mil of olive oil to 10 sprays of olive oil spray, or, you know, changed full fat cheese. It sounds like it's not cheese isn't Coca-Cola, cheese to low fat cheese. You know, just things like that. They taste the same, but you're eating the same volume. So yeah, anyway, good plug there for the book.
Oh, happily, man. linked in show notes below. What about supplements? Obviously, we've talked about some of the ones that aren't worth their salt. What supplements are worth it, in your opinion?
It depends what you mean by supplement. So if whey protein was a supplement, which I would say it probably is, despite the fact it's derived from eggs, you know, it's like, it's a supplement, let's just call it. I would definitely say whey protein. For the things we've discussed earlier, it can be difficult to hit that protein target each day. And whey protein provides a really convenient, and, you know, there's lots of flavors, tasty solution for that. You can do that within 30 seconds, mix up a protein shake or add it to yogurt, add it to porridge, pancakes, whatever. It's just really convenient. You don't need it. You know, you can get your protein from chicken, eggs, fish, you know, whatever. But it's just really convenient. So that would be the number one. You know, for supplements, I guess it depends on someone's situation. If somebody was perfectly healthy and consuming an abundant variety of different foods and whole foods, you'd probably say there isn't any need. But what I would say is in the UK, we are probably, a lot of us are deficient in vitamin D just because of the climate. So that is certainly one during winter months that I take up here in Aberdeen. I mean, Jesus Christ, January when we were in lockdown here, I don't think I saw sunlight for about 5 days at one point. So it's like, yeah, let's take two vitamin Ds every day, thanks. There's one. And things like multivitamins, again, are potentially just going to boost, you know, boost that functional health aspect. But you don't actually know what the benefits are. You can't see them. You know, it's like if somebody keeps getting colds or viruses all the time, vitamin C is known to kind of counteract that. So if they go on high doses of vitamin C and they don't get colds anymore, they will never know whether it was their overall lifestyle, improvement of sleep, of diet, whatever, or that supplement as well. So it, you'll never kind of know. Those would kind of be the ones that I would recommend. If you're at elite level sort of training, you know, powerlifting and things like that, and obviously elite level sport, that's kind of out of my level of expertise. So I would recommend consulting a sports nutritionist for that.
Yeah.
But there definitely will be supplements that will definitely give someone that extra 1%. Legal supplements, that is.
I mean, there's some illegal 1%. Ones that'll give you far more than 1%.
Some illegal
I would throw into the mix there, I'd say creatine for anybody that's going to the gym, whether you're a guy or a girl, 5 grams per day. You don't need to phase it. You don't need to cycle it on and off. I think
that
I'm
was
right.
Yeah, there's misconceptions about cycling on and off with creatine, but I think most of the research now suggests that that's something you don't need to do. It can just be something you take continuously.
One scoop.
And as you say, there's a lot of evidence out there just to show the benefits of taking creatine. Absolutely. Particularly if you're looking to build muscle, you know. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So creatine, I would also personally, for me, I add in a greens drink. So I find, I mentioned it earlier on, Athletic Greens is just awesome. It just means no one's eating enough vegetables. Like, not even the vegans are eating
not
enough
vegetables.
Not even the fitness chef himself is eating enough vegetables. Yeah. So yeah, man, like that. But that would be my, whatever it is, like a 6-car garage. And you can add in funky stuff. There's some good fat burners out there. Green tea tablets I've used for years. Omega 3-6s and stuff are good. But I wonder sometimes.
I think a lot of the problem is things like fish oils. Depending where you get them from, you need to make sure that the dosage is actually going to be effective. So a lot of the things that you get in the supermarkets, the dose is so low.
Is that right?
That it tends to be the more expensive supplements you get, and you maybe have to go to a specialist source, you know, and pay over the odds, but you're going to get a higher dose. Those fish oils. So it's kind of like, yeah, if you had two groups and someone took fish oils A and then there was another more kind of potent fish oil for group B, over time it'd be interesting to see, you know, what kind of reactions they would have to that, because there's definitely discrepancies in the dosage between these things, and people don't understand that. It's not commonly known. Even myself, I'm kind of looking at it in the supermarket going, yeah, fish oil supplement's good. I don't eat a lot of oily fish, maybe once every couple of weeks, which you should probably do it a little bit more regularly than that. So I'm like, yeah, fish oil supplement. I'm looking at it going, maybe you need to have about 8 of these instead of 2.
What about
so that's something to consider.
What about foods? What food types? What are the best foods that you found to make dieting less painful? Everyone's got a couple in their back pocket that they like to rely on.
Gosh, to be honest, in my personal experience, my diet, to be honest, I would just say make what you're eating taste good, because there's that kind of mindset of chicken, broccoli and rice for so many years. It was almost like a bodybuilding staple, wasn't it? Make what you're tasting good, because you can eat anything. I would definitely say unless you're vegan or vegetarian, focusing on lean sources of protein is going to kill two birds with one stone. It's going to get your protein level up there, and it's not going to result in excessive calories. So something like a chicken breast, 100 grams of that, you're talking about 100 to 130 calories if it's not got the skin on, compared to like a steak, which would be a lot more than that. But obviously that's providing a high level of protein as well. So lean sources of meat, plenty of fruits and vegetables. You know, filling your plate with vegetables is a great way to kind of reduce the calorie content and increase the volume. Same with fruit as well. If you're somebody who's trying to lose fat and loves snacking all the time, but you're snacking on things like Millionaire Shortbread, which is like 150 calories per centimeter. It's not quite that, but something like that. You know, yes, have that now and again, but having some high volume foods like fruit or low fat Greek yogurt, maybe a scoop of whey protein in there, you know, those types of things are going to make you full, hopefully, provide you with micronutrients for your overall health, but also get the volume up so that you're feeling full and you're less likely to eat for longer, which is going to support a calorie deficit. But
have you tried this Lindahl's Kvarg stuff? It looks like a yogurt, but it's technically a sweet flavored cottage cheese. So you can get it
kinda in like quark.
Yeah, it's very similar to quark. So some of them are cottage cheese and some of them are quarks. Dude, they have completely revolutionized the yogurt game with this.
I'll have to try them.
Asda. What,
do you get them in all the supermarkets?
Yeah, they're everywhere, but Asda certainly has a big group of them. So Skia have now brought out an increased protein small version of a pot, and it's the macros on the back of it. It's like Harry Potter's cupboard or something. Absolutely insane. So it tastes like a thick, nice yogurt, but is 0 grams of fat, like 0.5 or 1 grams of carbs, and 18 grams of protein. I'm like, this is just a protein supplement. It's mad. Yeah. So the ones that
tastes good. So it's like you're going to eat that. And presumably you get it flavored as well.
Oh yeah, dude. They've really gone quite sophisticated with it. There's like lemon cheesecake flavor. There's strawberry shortbread flavor. All with these macronutrient profiles. I'm telling you. So if you are considering, you're getting back into the gym, you're thinking, right, I need to get back on my diet. That's such a good hack. Charity popcorn, low calorie popcorn, I think is such an easy one. It does help to fill you up quite easily. I'm not a massive fan of the zero calorie or low calorie jelly. It's just something to do with the texture of that when I'm hungry. It's so slimy and it doesn't feel too good, but I know that a ton of buddies do that. Nando's sauce, as sauces go, is about as low calorie as you can get whilst still being not being a low calorie sauce. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I'm a big advocate of Nando sauce. I'm putting it on chicken a lot.
Very regularly.
I haven't quite elevated myself to hot.
When you compare that with like a reggae sauce, there's so much more sugar in one of those. It's mad. And you think, hang on, I could probably have another 50% of this meal if I got rid of that sauce. So Nando sauce, looking at some different types of quark, flavored quark, it'll be in one side of the yogurt aisle in your local supermarket, and charity popcorn, I think those are my hacks.
Yeah, I'm on those as well. I think popcorn is one that I love because it seems like such a big amount of food that you're eating. And obviously, though,
most
you
of it's air.
It's like fruit in a way that once you chew it, obviously fruit will just turn into
disintegrate
with mush.
Yeah.
And popcorn just disintegrates. Yeah, if you took one bit of popcorn, chewed it, you're like, what? Where's it going? Before you even swallow it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But yeah, there's some good fiber in there as well. So yeah, I agree with those 100%.
If it's got your stamp of approval, I'll take that. What about, what are some of the ways that people can improve their energy expenditure if they're sedentary for most of the day? A lot of us are still working from home. Perhaps we don't even have a commute to work. Maybe we've still got limited access to a gym. What are some of the easy ways that people can improve their NEAT?
Yes, the NEAT. So that accounts for around about 15% of your total daily energy expenditure for most people. So it's something we don't even think about. Like what we're doing here, fidgeting, using our hands, moving our lips, that's classed as NEAT. So yeah, I mean, walking technically isn't neat, but it kind of is. You know, it's not planned exercise. Well, okay, it is planned exercise, but let's not get pedantic. Let's include walking in neat. So things like, increasing the number of steps each day. You know, if you're able to walk, that is easy. That's an easy thing. It doesn't require you to do burpees, doesn't require you to lift weights if you're not comfortable doing that. And even like tasks like gardening and doing laundry, all these kind of things. And a lot of people obviously have been more sedentary over lockdown because they've been working from home or on furlough. But at work, depending on your occupation, if you are a nurse, I mean, being in hospitals, the amount of walking you have to do, because there are large buildings between area to area, is massive. And before you know it, they could be doing like 15, 20,000 steps on a shift. You just don't know. But another person, their mate, could be kind of on the same calorie spectrum for maintenance, they think, but they're actually sitting around all day. So their mate who's a nurse walking around, or whoever it is who's just generally
the guy that works reception versus the girl that's got to go and do the thing, they've been on the same shift for the same amount of time, but one's moved 15,000 steps and the other's moved 3,000.
Yeah, and it all adds up. It seems so insignificant because the effort to walk that slow pace or move or get up off the couch is a lot lower than doing a burpee, for example. But over time, it will just pick it up. So your BMR is around 70% of your daily energy expenditure for most people, which is just by breathing. And a lot of people don't realize that. A lot of people with these apps that are around now are kind of, it's measuring the calories burned, which is always going to be inaccurate. And they're kind of asking, do I need to deduct that from my calorie target? It's like, no, you just need to get a calorie calculator that asks you about your activity level, and it will tell you your calorie target based on your activity. So you just have to focus on that one number. You don't need to do any calculations after that. We discussed the thermic effect, which is about 10% of your daily intake just from food. It'd be higher if you consume more protein, or lower if you consume virtually no protein. And then that leaves 5% for planned exercise, unless you're doing intense exercise for like 4 hours a day, like triathlons. If you're like Ross Edgley swimming the North Sea or something, then that's going to be a lot higher. And I think someone like him would need like 10,000 calories or something a day just to maintain that. So increasing NEAT, going on walks with mates, taking up hobbies, walking dogs, all these kind of things all add up, because we're too sedentary, really. You got Netflix, you got TV with thousands of channels, you've got everything there, you've got social media, all of which requires you to be still when you're kind of looking at it. So it's kind of getting out of that a little bit and just moving a little bit more, so to speak.
My spine coach, Dr. Stu McGill, he gives all of his patients, this is a spinal input, because locomotion lubricates the spine in a way which actually reduces back pain, as long as you're swinging your arms. So you need that contra movement, so that you're doing this, your hips are going one way, your shoulders are going another. Mm-hmm. But he prescribes, after every meal, do a 15-minute walk. And when you actually put that together, if you're moving at an all right pace, that's your 10,000 steps and a bit. That's more than 10,000 steps within 45 minutes if you're moving at an all right pace.
I mean, absolutely. And there's things you can do. It's not just like, if you live in an area which is boring scenery, you just have to walk. You can listen to podcasts, music.
This one.
Yeah, this right one, obviously.
Here. Yes, thank you.
And then, you can even, if you're someone who talks to your mates on the phone, I don't think I've ever talked to a mate on the phone since like 2008, the most antisocial person. It's just like, text me or go away. But if you're chatting away for an hour about something, walk around when you're doing it. Like, I think I have like a nervous thing when I speak to someone on the phone, and when I'm indoors, I just walk around.
Dude, so let me tell you. Let me tell you about that. So I got this insight from, who wrote Becoming a Supple Leopard? He's been on this podcast.
Oh God, yes, I have.
He's got a girl's name.
I can't remember.
People scream, Kelly Starrett. Thank God for that. That would have annihilated me for the rest of the night. Yeah, I know. Hey, Kelly, I'm sorry, mate. He said, humans are locomotive beings, and he asks us to think about the last time we had a phone call that required a high level of cognitive load. So you're having a conversation with your business partner about the marketing copy for a new website, right? What's the tagline going to be? And naturally, you can't do it sat down. You have to get up and you have to move. And his argument is that it's something to do with how our movement facilitates our brain. It's not just a nervous twitch. It's not start trying to get rid of energy. It's facilitating the thinking process itself. And when you think about the fact that every great thinker that I admire from history, Albert Einstein, Newton, Darwin, all of these people decided to go for walks super regularly. They were avid walkers. And one of the reasons for that is that it's not just the neat effect. It's not just improving your fitness. It's about what you can do mentally when you're doing the walk. Yeah. So, dude, I'm all for it.
That's probably for a different discussion, but that's absolutely as important. Despite all of this kind of fat loss talk, mental health has to be the number one, doesn't it? So when we're talking about all these benefits of compositional change, the end goal is to make somebody happier. If they don't think any of this will make them happier, they don't have to do it. And it's as simple as that.
I love it.
So, yeah.
Dude, where should people go? They want to check out your stuff.
So probably the best place would be Instagram, and it's just The Fitness Chef on there. I've also got a website called fitnesschef.uk, and on there, what I've designed is basically like a tool for people who want to track their fitness journey. We're currently going through a bit of an update to the app at the moment, but on there they can track their food. There's lots of calorie counted recipes on there. Soon they'll be able to do a few other things, which I'll disclose soon, and they can have a free trial. So yeah, that's probably the two best places. Facebook, TikTok, those kind of things I'm on, but I'm not great at.
Is anyone great at TikTok? Unless you're a dancer, I don't think anyone's great at TikTok.
Yeah, I had a few videos late last year that went well, you know, getting a lot of views, and then decided to put myself in a lot more of them, and they went terribly, so I don't know what that's saying. but then last week I decided to do my infamous avocado Nutella post and just do a 30-second voiceover describing in basic terms what's going on. Yeah. And it's gone mental, yeah. And then I did an Easter egg recipe, like chocolate mousse died a horrible death. So you just don't know what's going on in there, which makes it exciting.
But it's because it's the Chinese, man. When they're observing you, they've heard that last night you criticized the communist regime, and then they press the button that nukes your account for the next week. Man, today's been awesome. Anybody that wants to check out your stuff, it'll be linked below. You need to give this guy a follow on Instagram. And yeah, man, let's think about something else. Get yourself in some more hot water with someone, and we'll bring you back on.
I'll be delighted to come back. So thanks for inviting me. Take care.